From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? We have a guest joining us shortly, a fantastic guest. But before we do, two altogether less impressive people joining us, and that is my partners in crime, Giles Morgan and Roger Mitchell. Giles, how are you, my friend?
I'm very good. Well, actually, I've been a bit under the weather, but can't whinge. Not allowed to whinge in this household, given very little sympathy. So just on a quick recovery now, but I'm trying to keep upright for the show.
Excellent. So I see the passive aggression classes are going well as well. Rog, how are you, mate?
I'm good. All okay. I just look around and see a sports sector that is ever more, it's bouncing off the walls. So can't wait to have our guest on because he's one of the guys.
You're like the muse of the sports industry, aren't you? I still have this vision of you wandering around in your sort of Italian style around Lake Como, just thinking and walking along the Alpine pathways.
That's not that far away from the truth, actually.
Yeah. Just steer clear of the loincloth, right? It only works for a very small group of people. Most can't pull it off, literally or figuratively. Anyway, listen, talking of which, Rog, you're walking and pondering. The article you put out on Sunday, I have to say, even by your own now lofty standards, was exceptional. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. That means a lot. Thanks.
For anybody who hasn't had a chance to read it yet, A, I would urge you to do that. And B, Rog, perhaps you could preempt it and give people a little taste of what they're in for, because there's plenty about which we can chat before our guest joins us.
Well, it was something that we talked about on GOG. We were going to talk about, you know, if we do all want to have relegation, and it seems that way, this side of the pond, then how can you make it work and sustainable? So I just, you know, wrote about that. And, you know, I guess the bottom summary is about a change in governance, hard salary cap. And I think quite interestingly, I think that the main thing that I thought about was just go the whole way and consider it as a regulated industry, the way that other social assets are, like water, telecoms, energy, all of that, which, you know, Grant, that's a very well-established way of doing things. You cap the amount of money that all the operators, which are monopolies, can earn, and then that leaves the industry of football capping its salaries like that, and with regulated returns, let's say no more than 10%, that leaves a whole lot of surplus of revenue over those costs that can be fed back into the game. So it was a little bit of a socialist manifesto of, you know, taking football back to the game that we grew up with in the 70s and the 80s. And all I can say is that, you know, a lot of people in the DMs came back to me, and because of that, they obviously chose not to reply to, you know, the stuff on social media, which means they don't want their opinion to be known, but just overwhelmed with the response. I think it struck a chord in terms of maybe it's the way this industry needs to go. But it was my attempt, Grant. You know, we are on here and we're, you know, bombastic every week and slagging everybody off because that's what we do. I just think at some point you have to put something back on the table. Otherwise, you're just a curmudgeon. And, you know, so that was my attempt at it.
So now when you say we are bombastic and we are curmudgeons, can you just elaborate on that a little, perhaps?
Well, I mean, I could say that you are equally so in your resistance to anything that looks innovative or not the way sport was 40 years ago. So we're both the same. We just come at it from different directions.
That's fair enough. I will accept that. I would say, well, listen, the People's Republic of Rogeria sounds perfect to me. Right? I like the manifesto. I like everything it stood for. And I thought it made an awful lot of sense. And, you know, you've got to start somewhere. Someone has to rip the band-aid off and suggest something, even if it's just putting a peg in the ground. And I thought that was an exceptionally worthy attempt to do that. And again, I would urge everybody listening to this that hasn't had a chance to read that, go over to albacchiara.net and read Roger's latest column. It was exceptional in thought and word, as I think I wrote in my tweet. Giles, what have you been up to, my friend, this week? Anything fun, apart from being sick?
Which has been no fun. Well, I've sort of I was going to ask you a question, actually. Obviously, it's at the crunch time of the NBA Finals at the moment, and I've sort of been quite interested to get your point of view on the Denver Nuggets and Miami Heat, just because we're in the middle of it, and I guess by the time this show is out, it'll be closer to the denouement. But that seems to be... I've sort of, because of you, I've got a bit more interested and started to follow that. But before I ask you that question, I was really chuffed. As we all know, Barry Hearn came on the show. He's been pushing darts. Eddie Hearn posted a piece on darts in New York City in Madison Square Garden.
Amazing, yeah.
And just fantastic. We talk about the alchemy of matchroom sport in terms of being able to put on events and taking them to other places and creating razzmatazz and carnival. The pitches, I know it wasn't the main Madison Square Garden, because I think Billy Joel was playing in the big arena. It was in the theatre arena. Just looked astonishing. And just, again, and that kind of relates back to the NBA, that whole sense of carnival party where American sport seems to get it so right, or often gets it so right.
Yeah, I mean, darts is the perfect sport for that, right? It's perfect for that, because it's just an excuse to dress up in stupid costumes, drink your own weight in booze, and have a great time. And it's you know, I thought those scenes from Madison Square Garden, I didn't realize they were doing that. When I saw the clips, I was shocked but not remotely surprised. You know, I didn't realize they were taking it over there. Roger, you're going to hate this, but I'm sure Ted Lasso has had a little bit to do with the renaissance of darts.
Oh, that scene, possibly.
I wouldn't poo-poo that as an idea, because it was, you know, it's a scene that keeps coming back when people are talking about that show, and it is such a popular show. But fair play to Eddie for doing that, because it looked like something I would love to go and see.
Very good fun. I am very much hoping that the three of us will be able to get to the PDC finals at Ali Pali, Alexandra Palace in London, at the end of the year.
We have an invitation
for that. And I do feel that, are you not entertained? Maybe we could do a live version or something, and the three of us go down there.
I've seen that already.
Charles, as for your early question about the NBA finals, it's crazy, right? The Miami Heat were the eighth seeded team in the East. And I think only the Knicks have ever gotten to the NBA finals as an eight seeded team before. And that was, when was the strike? 99, I think, when the season was shortened to 50 games because of a lockout. And the Knicks just about got into the playoffs, and they made it all the way to the finals, where they got battered, as they tend to do. But it's been amazing to watch the Miami Heat do what they've done. Every time they've come up against someone, they've been written off. They keep having these impossible comebacks. They did it again last night against the heavily favoured Nuggets. And so they've tied it up 1-1, heading back to Miami. By the time this goes out on Thursday, I suspect we will have played game three. So who knows? But it's going to be back in Miami. And it's been an amazing story. You know, it really has. It's captured a lot of people's imagination. I'm here in Nashville at the moment. There are a whole bunch of people that were heading off to watch the first game a few nights ago, and then the second game last night. It's a big deal. You know, people are energized and interested in it again, because it's not the Lakers and it's not LeBron and it's not Cleveland. It's not the same old stories that we've had for many years now. It's not the Warriors and Steph Curry. It's definitely captured people's imagination, and the basketball's been great.
Talking of capturing imagination, did you see Rose Zhang winning on the LPGA on her professional debut? Amazing.
Yeah, first time since 1951, I think someone's done.
That's right. A newcomer that's come in, turned pro, and won a tournament.
It's amazing.
The America's
Open. Women's golf is just so ready to be integrated into men's and joint tournaments. And I mean, they're really good. They're really good. And, you know, I saw your post on that, Giles. Just fantastic.
Yeah, it was. And she's quite some player. So I suspect, again, you know, we've seen these phenomenons come through women's golf a lot. You know, we had Annika and we had Michelle Wee, obviously, who was, who I know, Giles, you probably had some dealings with in your HSBC days, who was absolutely unbelievable. You know, and she had her time in the spotlight and did extraordinary things. And Rose Zhang looks like she is set to carry that mantle forward. And yeah, as you say, what a player she is.
Well, it's. I mean, Roger makes a good point, is that women's golf has been strong for a very long time. You think of Laura Davis in her pomp. You think of Sorensen, you think of Lorena Ochoa, who for a moment in time was just unbeatable. It's a sport waiting to be taken into the stars, because the skill sets are there, and they're not new skill sets. These are generational. These have been built on history. And why the sport hasn't spent more time embracing the two, I have no idea because it's more than time. It's beyond time.
Well, we have can I say, guys, sorry, Grant, just to segue into that, one of the big stories since the last time we three spoke has been the mess that FIFA have got themselves in over the Women's World Cup, where they've been pushing so hard on this idea of getting the prize money close to men that they've already declared what the prize pot is, which is a very significant amount. And guess what? The broadcasters aren't up for, you know, making that money for them. And, you know, you've got all this stuff that's now becoming very, very messy. And the words betrayal are being used. I don't know how you can use a word betrayal to a broadcaster who is running a business in a recession, in the middle of streaming wars, piracy. It's not their fault that FIFA went for the virtue signalling and overplayed their hand on the prize pot and now find themselves playing catch-up, trying to earn the revenues to pay for it. One of the huge boomerangs in the sport industry.
I agree, although, look, we don't know what was said or what was promised by the broadcasters, right? We don't know what conversations were had and whether FIFA just went off the end and said, we're going to do this, or if they'd been given, you know, strong indications that they would be able to do it and they just jumped the gun. Who knows, Rog? But either way, no one is going to shed a tear for FIFA having to put their hand in their pocket and make up.
Now, that comes out of the game. That's money that comes out of the game. FIFA is a non-for-profit. So everything they piss against the wall at this is just less money for the famous family, the famous grassroots. It's our money that they're spending.
Well, I suspect Sepp Blatter might disagree with the not-for-profit, but hey, at least his bank records might. But that's a whole other story. Listen, we have our guest joining us. As we said, Giles, why don't you let people know who is about to grace the Are You Not Entertained podcast?
Well, every now and then, I think we've discussed that we like to invite guests back, or some guests back on the show, particularly those who are investors in the sports industry, people who've put their money where their mouth is, and people who are always assessing the marketplace. And because of the political and social and economic shifts happening all over and around the world, which we cover all the time, it follows that that has going to have and is having a major impact on the world of sport. So we decided we want to bring back George Pine back on the show, the founder of Bruin Capital, to get a sense check on his world and his perspective on where things are for him right now and for the business for Bruin. As many of you know, before setting up Bruin in 2015, George was one of the kingpins at both NASCAR and IMG. And he's also hewn from the kind of rocks of an American sporting dynasty. So if anybody knows where sport is at right now, it's George Pine. So let's get him on the show. George Pine, a warm welcome back to Are You Not Entertained? It's, I think, been about 18 months since we had you on the show. And my goodness, an awful lot of water's flown under the bridge in the world of finance and sports since we last met. Great to have you back.
Great to be back. Good to be with you guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, George. Let's get straight into it, because you're one of the most important people in the industry, from not just, you know, where you are at Bruin Capital, but your whole vision as a sporting dynasty. You've got a view on where this industry is going. I wanted to start really directly with the last acquisition, Proof of the Pudding. And when I saw that, and then I looked at your portfolio, and there's a lot of stuff around, you know, in the marketing of sport, you know, Engine Shop and Soulside and all of that. Here's what I was thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong here. Are you putting together a competitor to Legends?
Yeah, I mean, we don't focus on what other people are doing. It's a really good question. I mean, I think what we're focused on is trying to find holes in the marketplace. And what we've found there is that really with premium hospitality, really specialized hospitality, we think there's an opportunity, you know, in that area. And this company I've known for 30 years, and you know, they've got great clients. They've got University of Alabama, Duke, Georgia Tech, the Atlanta Hawks. I mean, they've got a great roster of clients. And so I just think in the premium hospitality space, there's an opportunity. You know, Legends is in a lot of different lines of business. And so I don't, and they're formidable force. I think we're kind of focused on taking advantage of that premium hospitality space. Now, you know, look, we're buying a company. We love platforms. So over time, could you add services? Sure, you could. And you know, we'll kind of see where it takes us. And
well, I was just looking at TGI Sport, and you know, some of the other things you've got. You made recent blogs about lifetime value, and you've obviously got two circles. I certainly seem to think that the industry is maybe getting a little bit tired with legends, maybe a bit of a kind of like flabby monopolist. And I just looked at your portfolio and I thought, you put all these things together, and if I was legends, I'd be a wee bit scared of Brewin Capital.
Yeah, well, look, we don't focus on the other guys, what everyone else is doing. We focus on what we're doing. And Legends has been an incredible company and done amazing things. And Shervin, the CEO, is a good friend of mine, and I respect the guys at Sixth Street. So, you know, we're not really focused on what they're doing. We're kind of focused on, you know, what we're doing.
Well, they will be scared, George. You're 6'5" and you're a big lad. And to be honest, I should think they'll all be keeping their distance. But George, a question on this. You've made some amazing acquisitions and around the services of sport and where the value of sport is clearly where you feel it's going to going. Have the last 18 months, with the kind of the macroeconomic state of the world, do you get worried about how the sports industry is and therefore its ability to be serving as a client or clients who are investors through the businesses that you are involved with? Because the whole ecosystem has to work with sport being in rude good health. And clearly there are some stresses and strains there. And I wonder if that has affected your acquisition strategy or whether you're looking for great deals at particular moments. Does it change the strategy at all?
Well, it certainly impacts how you look at things, just in terms of general economic conditions. But I don't think you, like anything else in life, I don't think you're going to be very successful if you're always trying to time the market. I mean, people have been worrying about a recession since 2019, and maybe it will happen. Eventually, there will be one. So I think you have to be mindful of the general economic conditions, but you have to kind of press forward. And we really look for things that can grow. So, and in a lot of cases, we have a lot of tech companies. And so hopefully this tailwind there as well. So I think really just being convinced that the company can grow and being convinced that we can add value, we kind of soldier on, to be quite honest with you, and don't pause because of, you know, certain short term, you know, economic cycles. Because when we're buying a company, we're holding it, you know, for 5 to 10 years. And who knows where things are in 5 to 10 years. So hopefully it's a good company and your thesis to grow it is the right thesis.
The recession question is one that, as you say, has been kind of lingering for some time now. And the data coming out, particularly the US economy, is confounding every prediction that we're headed for a certain recession. But the one thing, obviously, that has changed, whether we like it or not, is the cost of capital, obviously. And we've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about that cost of capital. And the difference it makes, particularly in some of the assets that are A, extremely, let's call them fully valued and be generous, and B, reliant upon those very low rates to raise debt to maintain those valuations. Is it time now where the smart guys are starting to focus on the picks and shovels rather than the gold mines themselves? Because it seems to me as though it's tough now to find a way to get into the headline sports business by buying an NBA team or a soccer franchise. But as you've proven, to go into the places that supply all these things, there's a lot better value on offer and a lot more ways to skin that particular cat.
Yeah, I'll kind of try and answer both questions together. First, sports, one of the great things about sports is it holds up better in a bad economy. I mean, I lived through the financial crisis of 08 and 09, and you know, the better assets held up well. So sports is probably going to hold up better than others. And obviously, we all went through COVID, which for sports was that we didn't run events. And so I think the industry as a whole, at least of what we do, we're a lot, haven't been through the financial crisis and COVID. I don't know what's next, but, you know, hopefully we're prepared for it. The cost of capital, you know, is a challenge for investors right now. We at Brewin, and I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm not a financial engineer. And so we have very low debt on our companies, which is very different than other private equity firms. Other private equity firms are having anywhere from 4 to 7 terms of debt. At Bruin, we're probably 1 to 3. And so our guys are so, we don't create our value by the way we structure things financially. We create our value by actually working with the management teams. And that's why our debt is lower. And again, the reason guys put more debt on it is because you get better returns with the higher debt. But we've taken a different approach, which so far has worked out well. I argue with myself whether or not how smart I am to do that. But we go into this recession with all our companies very low debt, if there is indeed a recession. And the higher interest rates result in less companies for sale because, other financial buyers, because of the higher rates, they're unable to pay what they used to be able to pay. And so that's going to be an issue, you know, out there. One, it means less quality companies are for sale, and people can pay less than they used to. So that's really what we've seen. We haven't really seen any, on our companies, we haven't really seen any issues yet. Our companies have held up pretty stronger than I might even have realized. What it means for the teams, I don't know. I mean, when you look at the last 12 or 24 months, I mean, Chelsea, the Phoenix Suns, I mean, the Phoenix Suns at a $4 billion valuation is an amazing valuation. So when you sit there and say, how long can it go? I have to say, you know, I don't know, right? I mean, I think it's funny. The guy that bought the Denver Broncos for $4.5 billion got a steal. But when you look at the Suns for $4 billion, right? And then you have the Washington Commanders going for $6 billion, and you see all these other, you know, Arctos and Dial, and so I don't know how it really impacts the team valuations. Teams benefit by a scarcity of assets, right? There's only a certain number of them. And they're underpinned by linear media, which is a bit of a challenge right now. But long term, you know, I believe that the linear media will go to, you know, you'll have streaming. We also have new revenue streams of the lifetime value of the consumer. You know, on Amazon, you know when somebody watches, where they're watching it from, and how long they watch it. That's never happened before. And so I think sports long term is probably a pretty strong asset class. And I think that's why, you know, when I started this, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, there were not a lot of people in the space from a financial perspective. And boy, there seems to be a lot of people in the space today. And you are right. We're different. Like, we're really the picks and shovels guy. We probably don't do glamorous things, but we're good at the picks and shovels, and we're not going to lament what we're good at. We'll celebrate it. You know, we're good at working with management and building companies.
George, let me come on to the thing about the media rights, which is in many ways Giles's question about how much this sector is going to be prosperous going forward. We can all have different views about whether we're bears or bulls and how it's going to polarise and everything like that. The streaming wars, you know, the Zanzlavs of the world and how tight they're going to get with their bids for sports rights. All of that is something, feel free to answer if you want, but my question is more specific. Again, reading your work in the last few months, there was two articles that caught my eye. The one about the regional sports network and obviously, you know, what's happened to them. And you were saying how it's left some teams exposed and they should look to mitigate that risk by going for multiple partners. And then in the other article, you said you were talking about how you found the Apple MLS deal fascinating because that was just one partner. How do you feel about that? Because certainly in this side of the pond, there is subscription fatigue. The fans are very upset at having to subscribe to 2 or 3 different platforms to get coverage for their sport. But that's the way it's going, as you rightly say. Do you think that's sustainable? Even the NFL seem to be going all in on just fragmenting across so many different platform partners.
Yeah, it's a very complicated question in general, but then when you look at different territories, it's also different too. So I can speak a little bit to the U.S. I'll speak to the U.S. kind of going backwards. I mean, the NFL, of course, has got 120 or 30 billion of contracted media rights revenue. So they're kind of at the high end of the gene pool. And what they're doing is they're going with Amazon and others, YouTube, to really have their content in front of young consumers, because their bulk of their content's tied up with an old linear, which is going to be a little older. So they're using those other platforms to reach young young people as best that they can. You know, in the U.S., you know, we've been debating this. I'm sure you have, like you said, what's going to happen? Our team valuation is going to slow down and so forth and so on. And of course, they're underpinned by the media rights. And, you know, look, that's a question we can debate. But what you can't really debate is there's a crack in the regional sports networks. And those regional sports networks deliver a lot of free cash to the clubs. And so that's going to change, and that's not going to be replaced in the short run. You know, in the long run, the lifetime value of the consumer is a whole new entry point for clubs and teams. But that's going to take a long time for the clubs and teams to be really good at that, because you're really talking about being an expert marketer. And are they going to build the infrastructure for that? Are they going to partner with someone to do that? You know, remains to be seen. And even the streaming guys, I'm focused more on the U.S., do they view sports the same way that Fox or CBS might have? I mean, CBS, when they lost the NFL, went way down. When Fox came to America, what'd they do? They bought the NFL. They became relevant. And so for a media company, those rights are invaluable. For a streamer, they're kind of nice to have. They're kind of more of a sponsorship, but they're not the bane of their existence. So there's a tension point there. And then, as you point out, in Europe, where you have way more territories and you don't have this pan-European strategy, it's even more difficult, right? Because the rights come up every 3 years, and you're going to be more susceptible to the linear diminishment in terms of revenue and the ability to pay, and you're going to have all these streaming services. I think for a while it becomes more fragmented, and then eventually it probably consolidates. So you're kind of going through, and I look at this thing as a period of change, because the money's in the old media and the future's in the new media, and there's a transition there that we're all kind of navigating through. And in that transition, so will the direct-to-consumer capabilities will be part of that. But I just think it's going to play out over time. And look, there's going to be some winners and losers too. I mean, I had this thing I learned 30 years ago. When the channels of distribution change, there's big winners and losers. And there are going to be winners and losers in this thing. And who they are right now, I don't think it's real clear, but there are going to be winners and losers. I think the sports fan probably is a winner in a way, because the sports fan is going to be able to get more content in more different ways and probably richer content than they might have got, you know, years ago. What they have to pay for it, that'll be a tension point, you know, also.
George, in your long career, you've worked with global organizations like IMG, you've worked in NASCAR, which I know is international, but very much focused on North America. And now with what Bruin is doing, investing across the globe with companies that will serve the sports industry. We were talking earlier in the top of the show that Darts has just put on quite a big event at Madison Square Gardens, the Professional Darts Corporation, which is very much a British sport that has internationalised through the Hearn Empire, Barry and Eddie Hearn. At the same time, we had about 6 months on the show, we had Steve Kuhn from Major League Pickleball, the sport that seems to be sweeping America at a kind of community level. And I imagine that they're looking on the rest of the world for potential growth. And you have paddle or paddle, depending on which territory you come from, more European and kind of, well, Mexican, I guess, originally, more Iberian, I guess. My question, you were willing me to get to the point, and I got there in the end, is who do you think can learn from what in terms you've got European powerhouse and you've got American sports and skill sets? As you look at the world of sport, which is a big universe, there are some new runners and riders coming into new territories. Who can learn from who?
Well, I think it goes both ways. I mean, I'll take a plug for a second on Bruin. I mean, our portfolio companies have people on the ground in 16 countries, and our portfolio companies do business in 50. And really what we've kind of fallen into, I wouldn't say it was by design, is we became an importer of great non-US companies to America. So what I can say is there are great companies all over the world. And I've only seen really great, when you said, give me an example, great European companies. Well, I think Deltrade was a great company, Two Circles, Odds Checker, and TGI is a Melbourne based. And so I've seen some amazing non-US companies that can be very relevant, you know, in the US. So I think it goes both ways. It depends on the company, the sport, in the situation. I do think the world is way more globalized than it might have been, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. I think when I spent 9 years at IMG. Of course, I got my indoctrination early on. And, you know, early on, IMG was kind of the global guy, right? But now I think, you know, the possibilities of people being global goes both ways and are really limitless, really through technology. I think technology makes anything possible. Even our company, Full Swing, you know, it's 5% of their business was non-US. They're now going to be around 15 or 20%. We hope to get that number up. So I don't think borders, I think technology changes all that. And I think there are really bright and talented people everywhere. We've tapped into the non-US people more than we have the US people. And we've been a good guy to open up the US market. But we have some amazing companies with amazing leaders and great products all over the world.
George, on that, let me ask you a little bit about your process, if I can, in terms of whether you guys map out a strategy and you look for a place in the sporting ecosystem that you think offers value as a space and then look for a company potentially in that space that maybe satisfies your needs, or whether you're constantly monitoring companies and then seeing if they fit into the Bruin Capital ecosystem. Which way around and how do you think about that?
It's kind of both. I mean, the number one thing when we look at a company is, you know, can we make a difference? Can somebody with us, can we open up markets for them? I mean, I get excited about TGI is now in America and in Europe in a much more relevant way than it was when we bought it, right? So initially, you know, DeltaTrade, when we sold DeltaTrade, half of the business was the U.S. And when we bought DeltaTrade, it had no U.S. business. And so it's fun for me to, we're opening up markets, right? And so when we looked at TGI, we're like, hey, we think with us, we can do things with TGI than they couldn't do on their own. Or DeltaTrade, we think we can add real value, or Two Circles, or any of these other companies. And I look at it this way, I'm very conservative. So if the management presents us a plan, and that's great, and we hope that we can accelerate that plan. And if for a chance the management misses its plan, we're kind of an insurance policy. So the number one thing for us is, can we make a difference? We like tech because tech is disruptive and has it's easier to grow. But look, we had a great experience in On Location. That's why proof in the pudding for me is natural. And the management team. I mean, it sounds corny, but now as I get older and I get smarter, I mean, you got to have really good management. And we've bought 40 companies. And we replaced two management teams. So, like, you won't find a lot of guys that do what we do that stick with management like we do. And so, like, really who the people are, you know, like, really matter to us.
George, I was going to ask you about those two exits because those are the most fascinating things about funds I find. Why did they exit? You know, I was going to ask you about On Location because, you know, as you say, it's a sector you clearly like. You've got into it again with Proof of the Pudding. And I was going to ask you about DeltaTrade. DeltaTrade, that whole sector, I know relatively well. And I've publicly said, I think you did the deal of the century there, selling it that for that valuation. You could disagree with that. I think it had some technical debt and it was falling behind some of its competitors. But that, my question is this, why do you and how do you come about to take Grant's point, come about a process when you say, now's the time to get out?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In both cases, the management team came to us and said, hey, we've created a lot of value. We want to realize it. So ironically, you know, when you go into this thing, as anyone should, suspicious, you think it's the financial investor that's the guy pushing the exit. Maybe that's the case, but I'm not a financial investor, although I am, but I'm really not at heart, right? I'm an operator at heart. And so what's happened in both those cases is the manager teams came to us and said, hey, we've created a lot of value. We want to realize it. And when we sit down with the management team to buy a company, our sales pitch is, hey, we're going to help you create a lot of value. And so that's been our experience so far. We've never gone to a company and say, hey, it's time to go. They've more come to us and said, hey, we want to realize the value. And in both those cases, we really increased the earnings of the company. I mean, in the case of DeltaTrade,
no doubt.
Fivefold increase, the same, even more on Location, more than fivefold. I don't know, would it be seven or eight times the earnings when we sold it than when we bought it. And so with that kind of growth, if you're a shareholder in that company, and the shareholders want their chance to be successful after the company's been successful. And obviously, we're aligned with the shareholders because we benefit as well. And that's how it worked with those guys. And it's a good approach. So let's hope it keeps going that way.
George, let me have one follow-up on this one. And forgive me, this is prickly, but we wouldn't be doing our job unless we ask this, anybody that's involved in asset management these days. My premise is this one, that I think it would be difficult to get the same valuation for Delta 3 that you got when you sold it because the markets have changed. Can I ask you what you're doing around mark to market in your portfolio businesses, and if you feel comfortable that that's reflecting the change that we've seen in the last 18 months?
Well, first of all, there are no bad questions, just bad answers. But again, we're very conservative on our valuations. In fact, when we did our first valuation for Bruin 2, our investors asked us why we were so conservative. So for us, we don't have aggressive valuations. We get aggressive when we sell. So again, we're probably different. Again, being more of an operator and less of a financier, even though in the end of the day, I am a financier, we're more conservative. So that really for us has not been an issue. No, and by the way, we started being conservative 7 years ago, so we haven't changed, right? So we were conservative during the bull market. When things go slower, we're not changing by external forces. So, you know, we don't put a lot of debt on it. We're not aggressive in our annual evaluations. You know, we're pretty conservative. So it hasn't been an issue for us, but it's an issue for the private equity industry.
100%.
100%. There are a lot of guys that are underwater on that. And we're not the rabbit. We're the snail. We kind of go slow.
Excellent.
George, just on that, I'm really curious as to how you managed to do that, because it's a very difficult thing to do, particularly if you look at those 7 years that you've talked about. They've been seven of the crazier years in this industry for many, many reasons, whether it's the chaos of the pandemic or just the abundance of liquidity in the markets that have driven all these valuations up. And there has to be pressure during that period, both self-imposed pressure, because one looks at one's peers and sees all the headlines and all the stuff that's going on, and also from investors. How do you manage that pressure mentally and inside yourselves? And what's the pressure been like from other investors who are keen to understand that conservatism?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of fortunate by the investors that I've had, I guess. I mean, because in Bruin 1, there were really six wealthy families and then one financial investor. And so I never really felt pressure from them to do much. And then in Bruin 2, which is a different set of investors, but still, you know, they were the ones asking why are your valuations so low? Or, you know, and we gave an answer. Well, hey, this is how we've always done it. And they were good with the answer. So I've never had anyone put pressure on us. And I think a couple of things. You know, a lot of the private equity firms are always thinking about raising this next and raising more money. And I'm not saying that we don't think about that too, but I'm more focused on being successful with what we have and less successful about, hey, we got to do this because we got to get here. And so I think that's probably the difference. I kind of went slower and was more operator focused than somebody that says, okay, we've raised two vehicles. Let's run. We got to do this to raise a third. So we got to get this certain mark to market. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to do our third fund or something like that. We've never really looked at it that way. Now, by the way, the other guys that do that, they may be better at what they do than we are, or, you know, we're just different, right? And that's based, I think, probably more on my background than it is. We're trying to be a contrarian in the market.
And I was going to ask you, George, do you think that is? You were one of the very first into private equity, into the sports industry, or certainly early compared to the numbers that are there now. But your career has been so much in sport, as you use the term, an operator. Do you think that's been part of the attraction, is that you do know what you're talking about, that you really, this isn't just about numbers, this is about the reality of the businesses and how they operate within the ecosystem that exists, and an ecosystem which is changing month by month, particularly through technology and digital and consumption. Do you think your finger on the pulse and the people I know you'll have within your investment team, and I know some of them, as you know, personally, that they're people who come from the industry rather than just brilliant at maths?
Yeah, no, 100%. And so we don't really feel like, even though you're right, I mean, it's unbelievable how many investors are now in sports compared to, like I said, 8 or 9 years ago. However, you know, I don't feel like we don't run into anybody. And so we do a lot of bilateral things where people want to be with somebody and they want to be with us. And if we're in a process, you know, we don't face the same person all the time. There might be a private equity firm that we compete with on this situation, but there's never anybody that we're consistently battling because there's nobody really focused on the picks and shovels of sports. Most people are investing in the teams or the federations. We're the picks and shovels guy. Occasionally a guy will jump in on a pick and shovel, but that's an exception versus the rule. And that's really been, and that's our point of difference too. I mean, I other thing is when things go bad, you know, I think we, in business, I think some of your best stuff is on defense. So when things go bad, like, we're really good guys to be around. And look, we're not perfect. We make mistakes. I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. But I think in balance, if you talk to our CEOs, they're pretty happy guys. And you know, our companies don't have boards. It's me. And I tell everybody when we invest in your company, the only person you're always going to see is me. Well, that could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what you think about me. But we don't have, you know, 17 committees. We don't have boards. And so it's a very entrepreneurial and friendly thing for a CEO and a management team. And so our guys are pretty happy with the process. We're very nimble. And we're very good when things go wrong. And we also open doors. So I think the combination of all of that, if you said, what's the Bruins secret sauce? That plus really having a global footprint. And we have 13 advisors all around the world that have worked for some of our competitors. Some of them are guys who worked at IMG. Some are people in this industry that aren't ever affiliated with me. But all of that is, if you're a management team, is attractive, I think. And that's our point of difference.
That definitely is, George. And we really are. I mean, I can tell you, without any embarrassment, that some of the work that I've done with other people about how they should set themselves out in terms of actually doing and also narrative around investing in sport, I always point them to your website, because frankly, the crafting of it is really, really good, George. But enough of the compliment. It's never a good idea to say to me there are no bad questions, because that is opening the gate. Right. So here we go. In your recent partnership with CVC, you've got into bed with one of those private equity firms that, I'll leave my colleagues aside here, I've personally been very critical about in terms of how they've dealt with rugby. How do you, if you do, go to them and give them a little bit of an idea about what you should be doing if you're making investment into, what you said earlier, the governing bodies as opposed to the picks and shovels? Are they listening to you, George?
Yeah, well, look, we have a great relationship with them. They've been very supportive. And, you know, when you go out and ask people to invest in you and believe in you, I don't know how to say it, but this is an enormous sense of gratitude, right? And I take it very seriously. But, you know, to their credit and our credit, you know, we're not really involved in, you know, what they're doing on any of their investments. They do refer our portfolio companies from time to time, but strategically, we're not really involved. And look, nor should we be. I mean, we're owned by four. We have four investors in Bruin 2, and our discussions at the board level are all about Bruin 2 and not about, you know, what any of the other investors might or might not be doing in sports. So we're really not. We're kind of focused on Bruin 2 and Bruin, and they're focused on helping us in Bruin 2. Obviously, we're here to be helpful in any way that we can. But that's not really commenting on their strategic decisions, positive or negative, is not a role that we
I know, but I tried. You've got to give me credit, George. I tried.
It's okay. Like, they're a very successful firm. They're one of the best in the world at what they do. And again, we're proud to be in business with them.
George, let me take you back to this this idea of opening doors, because I have a good friend of mine who is very active in the sports world at the kind of franchise level. And I remember having a meeting with him a few years ago, and despite all the money and the stuff that comes with a place at that level of the ecosystem, he said to me, by far the single biggest asset I have is my Rolodex. He said, you know, and he gave me a great example of some guys that came in with a sugar-free candy product, and they were struggling to get any traction. And he said to them, look, you know, what do you guys need to make this business a success? Because the product is great. You know, that's why we invested in you. And they said, you know, we need to get into a CVS or a Walgreens or, we need to get into these corner drugs. If we can crack that, then we think that's the difference maker for us. And so this buddy of mine stepped out the room, and he came back 15 minutes later, and he said, right, you're seeing the CEO of CVS on Monday, you're seeing the CEO of Walgreens on Tuesday, don't screw this up. And that was that. And that ability to open those doors can mean the difference between success and failure for a business. You know, so how do you go about cultivating that network, building those alliances and those friendships and those relationships? Because obviously they have to be a two-way street. It can't just be, hey, there's a guy I can ring every 6 weeks when I need a favor. How do you go about doing that? Because it's such an important part of what you do.
Right. Well, you know, it's really 30 years of hard work.
Right.
Right. At IMG, I get to know a lot of people at NASCAR. Obviously, we know a lot of people in the U.S., but we know a lot of people outside the U.S. I probably sell ourselves short outside the U.S. So the first thing is you regularly go see these federations, and you regularly see people when you don't want something. So I have a list of people, and I go see them all the time, and just to say hello. And over a 5-year period, you know, it might be. And by the way, you're helping them. I always think if you give, you know, you get something back. That's number one. I think number two, yeah, we can get people in the door, but no one's going to hire somebody because they're owned by Brewing Capital. You might get a chance, though. You know, there's two things. You probably get in the door, and we probably get good intelligence as to what our challenges might be. But I think that's just 30 years of hard work building relationships. And I'll, even now, myself, I mean, I spend a lot of time with people. And I don't look, when I go to meet somebody, I don't look, say, hey, I'm working on this. I just go see people. I tell our story. I ask how we can be helpful. And I see them. I've been doing it for a long, long time. And it's just a better, it's the best approach. And I think, again, if you're some on the other side of it, I want to learn from good companies. Doesn't mean I'm going to hire them. But I think it's a two-way street here. So if you're buying a, if you're buying a Delta Tray, I might want to, you know, when we bought them early on, they were deep in UEFA. I might want to learn what's going on in Europe. How do those best practices apply here in the U.S. and vice versa? So I think, honestly, the honest answer to that is 30 years of hard work.
Yeah, okay.
George, I have a question sort of related, though. In your old life, you were IMG, which was for a long time synonymous with the game of golf. The game of golf is going through extraordinary time in its history, which is well documented. And the money, the kind of money that that LIV are throwing at their events to try and compete with the PGA Tour. And I know from some of the suppliers and people that I've worked with in the golf industry in my former life that you know about, that they're being told that if they offer services to one side, then the other side will not be able to hire them going forward. I just wonder, when you have such a major schism in a sport like golf, but it, let's be honest, there's probably other sports where new money is going to be coming in, and the service industry is going to be potentially affected by who it can work with. Does that worry you? And I'm not talking specifically about your clients, just more generally.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot there that you to unpack. I mean, I think one of the things about that, it's odd for me just looking on, not taking a side. You know, the PGA Tour is a player-run organization, right? And so you have a group of players unable to get along amongst themselves, and therefore, you know, economic opportunity has been presented to some players somewhere else. It's really not, usually you have the owners and the players, right? Here you have the players, and they can't agree, right? And I guess if you're criticizing the tour, maybe they give too much to charity, and that should be going to the players. Maybe the PGA Tour invests too much to grow the game of golf, and that should be going to the players. But it is an odd dynamic when it's players versus players. the other thing that strikes me, I use this as an American example, but they, you know, there's this company called Anheuser-Busch, and they kind of ignored the rest of the world, and they were in a global business, and they were taken as a proud American company controlled by a proud American family, and got bought by somebody that wasn't American because they ignored the rest of the world. And, you know, when you're in business, and golf is a global business, you have to have a global purview. And I think all these sports have to have a global purview. And if you ignore the rest of the world for whatever reason, and, you know, there's capital sloshing around, it provides opportunity. So I think that the lesson is, if you're in a global sport, you have to get up in the morning thinking about, how am I taking advantage of that platform? And if I'm not, somebody else will. Like when I was at NASCAR, you know, when I got there, we owned our sister company owned three racetracks, and it took $300 million facilities to run the races. So the guys who owned the tracks were the guys that had a lot of say. And then we had a guy named Bruton Smith who started buying up racetracks. And I can remember he bought the Bristol Speedway for $21 million. At some point, those tracks were going for $300. They've probably come back down now. Like, that took my breath away. So we at NASCAR were always thinking about the different threats, right? And so when you're a global business, even if you're not global, you only want to operate in a certain territory, but if you're a global business, you got to have a global plan. And so that's a good question. I think that it could happen in other sports with the capital sloshing around and some of these sports being global. I think you have to be prepared for that if you're running a federation or any business.
George, let me come back to your portfolio. Odds Checker. A couple of things with Odds Checker that I'd just like to ask you about. I get the whole thing. Let's take a great business into the States, the opening betting market in the US. I get that. That's clear. A couple of things. I think Odds Checker in the UK and Europe, you would think that at this point it must be pretty saturated. It can't have an awful lot of room for growth left, especially when it seems clear that the football authorities, the soccer authorities here in the UK have started to really have a go at betting the way they did with cigarettes and alcohol sponsorship and everything like that. Is the Odds Checker the whole play now based on the US gambling market?
Well, look, it has a good business in the UK, so we want to continue to build that business in the UK. It, you know, it was primarily a horse racing business, so I think there are opportunities in football beyond what they've been historically. So I think there's opportunities to grow in the UK and Europe, but clearly the United States, you know, is the opportunity. Look, the UK, the US is, I think, market is seven times bigger than the UK, and Odds Checker is number one in the UK. So at the most simple level, it'd be the top five guy in the US. You don't have to be number one. You could be in the top five or 10. And we've got a good investment, and only half the U.S., only half the states are approved. So it was certainly a U.S.-led strategy, and there wasn't the dynamic going on in the U.S. We would not go there. You know, one of the things, too, and you know, knowing gambling was coming to America was hardly a secret. So for 7 or 8 years, we were looking for something that would be a good platform. But there's so much money sloshing around in the gambling space. You didn't want to get crushed by these big giants. And so Odds Checker for us was a kind of a too big for a small guy and too small for a big guy, and kind of a perfect place for us to play. And the opportunity for growth in the U.S. is relationships with media entities and or clubs and leagues. So we felt like we were well positioned. But 100% the focus, you know, the growth opportunity is in the United States. But you know, every business that we're in, we're always trying to grow. Because I think if you're a company and you don't have a growth strategy, by definition, you're shrinking. And so if you wake up in the morning and say, I can't do anything with this business, let's just hold on to what we have, by definition, you're shrinking. So I don't believe in not trying to grow wherever you are, but certainly the prospects in the U.S. are pretty attractive.
Yeah. One last question from me. Your last piece was about AI. And I personally have been a bull on AI, as I think you are, reading that piece certainly, for a long time. What you wrote about that is very dramatic in terms of how it's going to affect the possibilities to monetize IP, bring back old IP and create simulated events. Giles will love this one, allow you to monetize your archive a lot better. There's a lot of people in our industry that, as always, you know, the kind of Luddites, they say, oh, this is just the latest. This is the latest fad. It's transient. It's the latest shiny thing. Could you tell us a little bit why you think this isn't, and I think your phrase was, I haven't seen anything like this since the start of the internet.
Yeah, and I think I was at a conference and they saw, and I really wasn't a great AI guy, but you know, they were saying, you know, now you can make songs without people and you can write songs without people, good songs. Like there's an algorithm. I have a friend in the music business. They said that if you take the top 400 songs of all time, there's kind of an algorithm even to the song. So if you can write a song and you can sing a song with a machine, as an example, to me, that's like, wow, I got to take that seriously, right? And then we won't even go to the commercial side. Although now any company we look at, you really have to ask yourself, will it be disrupted by AI? You have to. And the second thing is just think about statistics. Right. My son's a quarterback. He was a quarterback last year at the University of Notre Dame. He transferred this year to
Arizona State.
Arizona State. And you know, like, just think about the data that through AI that you're going to have in measuring yourself, measuring your team, measuring your opponent. Remember, they used to have in America, they have guys, coaches going in and taking notes of what somebody does. Now you're going to have a machine that's going to be able to tell you everything about the performance of yourself and somebody else. And so, like, I don't see how it's not, you know, transformative. And it's just going to make a lot of things possible that weren't. It will, as a citizens of the world, it's going to accelerate the good and it's going to accelerate the bad, much in the same way the internet has. And so whoever you are, you know, you do have to start paying attention to it, I think.
George, just in closing, we've been told that Bruin is, like we do, we have our sports conference in Como that Roger dreamt up and we had last year. And I understand that you'll be hosting a conference in America. Tell us about that. That sounds like a brilliant idea. Although I bet the food is better in Como.
Yeah, you know, I don't like to talk about it too much, but I did apprentice under Ted Forsman, who ran an incredible conference, the Forsman Little Conference, and he had all kinds of it. Prime Minister of Pakistan and all kinds of leaders from Tony Blair and all kinds of different people from around the world. And then I had the privilege of going to Sun Valley for a number of years. And so in America, there was no similar thing in the U.S. So we've had a gathering of, you know, we had a number of leaders from America. And we brought in, you know, I want you to know, we had Boris Johnson came, he spoke, and George Bush, and we had three people from the Biden administration as well. So we're not partisan on any side of the aisle, but it's really bringing together people from the sports world, but not to talk about the business of sports, to talk about trends. So we had representatives from the U.S. military. We had a global economist from around the world, and we talked about the issues of the day. Actually, the AI was one of the topics. So it's just trying to bring a bunch of people together to talk about what's going on.
Isn't it such a brilliant thing to do with whatever gathering, if you get the right people in a room in the right atmosphere, and it's proper talking rather than people flogging stuff, whether pitching, but actually people are listening. It's so additive. I think that for the event that we did, and it sounds the same with the people in the room, you just get good conversations and hopefully get advancement as well.
Yeah, and you know what's great about it is you really do make friends. I mean, I have friends from the Forsman Little Conference, friends from Sun Valley, and definitely making friends out of here. And it's small. We only have like 130 or 140 people. So you're right. There's no flogging, and it's friendly. And we had a great mentalist there. It was fantastic. So David Hill's an old friend of mine. He used to run Fox Sports and all that. And the mentalist got up and asked David, he goes, can you remember the first girl you had a crush on and what her name is? And the guy got her name. I don't know how he did it. So it was an incredible mentalist. So we have all kinds of cool things you wouldn't expect from a guy like me. and people had a blast. So I got to go to your I got to go to your event. I know in the future, but I got this thing called America. I think it's in the Five American Football, and you know, at some point, my son's not going to play anymore, and you know, I want to be a good dad and be there for my child. But
yeah. I wanted to ask about that, George. I wanted to ask about that because, you know, we were close to having you in Como last year, but it clashed with Drew. Can I ask you, because I have been following his career principally because of who he's son of, what was behind the move from Notre Dame to Arizona State? What was in his head?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I really can't. I got to let my son speak for himself on that one. My role at Bruin, I'm the spokesman, but for Drew Pine's the spokesman. Look, we love Notre Dame. He played 17 games. He was MVP against Wisconsin 2 years ago. Last year was MVP for Clemson. He was 8-2 and 4-1 against the top 25. So I'm really proud of him and grateful for Notre Dame. But beyond that, Drew's the guy that's going to talk about Drew. I don't mean to be invasive, but
that's fair.
That's
fair, George.
Yeah, sorry.
That's fair.
Well, I'll tell you what, George, we must let you go, but I'm hoping that when you're next over in Europe or we're over in America, because Grant's over in the States most of the time, I think there's a cracking game of pickleball to be had. I've not yet played it. I'm told it's amazing, and I think you can be our host and teach us some of the basic rules, and I think that'd be a lot of fun. But genuinely, on behalf of all of us at Are You Not Entertained, to have you on the show, I think it was about 18 months, so we're definitely going to have you back in the future if you'd be kind enough just every now and then just to give us your top-up and thoughts. It's absolutely brilliant to hear your views on what's going on in the world, and congratulations on the ongoing success at Bruin Capital. It's great to see.
My pleasure. Great being with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, George. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, George. Thanks.
Take care. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Marvelous. 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 Just fascinating, you know, to understand how guys at this level operate, you know, because...
I loved his line about defense and offense and just being the defensive player, which he says he's always been, and presumably that's reaping rewards right now.
You know, it's funny. It's a peculiarly American thing, this understanding of how important networking is. And by that, I don't mean that kind of trite phrase, oh yeah, I'm networking. But this idea of going to spend time with people when you don't need anything from them, there's no deal to be done, but just, you know, spending time with people and getting to know them, you know, that's how you build these networks. That's how you build the ability to do what Bruin do in opening these doors for companies. And it makes such a difference because it's based on something, and here's that word again, Roger, authentic, right? It's based on an authentic relationship. It's not transactional. It's not, hey, this guy can help me achieve an aim. It's like, oh, you know who'd be good to call? This guy, and he's a buddy, and I can have a straight-up conversation with him about this business, and they can help us. I think it's tremendous what they're doing. I really do.
I think that conversation brings out something that maybe didn't come out fully the last time, which, you know, I always think about how are people making money? How are they? What's their thesis? So the question you asked, and Bruin's very clear, you know, like he's more of a founder and an operator, but he basically says, I'm going to take something that works, that's already got product market fit, and I'm just going to take it into new markets with my network. You know, he did that with Delta 3. He's done that. He's doing that with OddsChecker. And that's very compelling. You know, you don't have to believe that your product is going to change the world or going to completely knock out the incumbent. You're just going to say, I'm going to take it into a new market, a bigger market in the case of the States. And, you know, when you've got his credibility and you've got that network, that's a very, very winning formula.
Yeah.
And Bruin certainly is, you know, one of the leading companies in the space.
All right, gents. Well, that's it for another show. Our thanks to our guest, George Pine, for taking the time to sit and chat with us today. It's always entertaining and hugely interesting when we get a chance to do that. Our thanks to you out there for listening. As always, we appreciate each and every one of you. And my thanks, obviously, to Roger and Giles. If you don't follow us on Twitter, you can do that very easily. You just need to look for Entertained R. That's the word A-R-E. You can find me, should you have any desire to do that, at TTMYGH.
And you can find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, until next time.
Thank you. Great stuff. Thanks.